B. McKenna, Reel 3.
Battalion, we were going forward with Russian tanks, all moving forward. Right. And there was the Ebro on one side, about half a mile of ground, and this long, narrow road running up towards this place, I forget what it was called, and sticking up as this church tower. Mm. In this church tower, the observers and the snipers. And we were on this side of the road, there's some hills to the left, and we got our communications unit there. And there's a battalion, but this was supposed to be dawn, but it was about midday before the attack started. No aeroplanes came over, there was a sporadic artillery fire, and then the tanks and the artillery went into, and the infantry went into attack. And they got bloody slaughtered.
I made a mistake there when you said very young bullshit he did. It was his second bullshit he did that I was on.
Oh, this was the first one when we took Belchite, Kintel, and moved up. Anyway, our job, and I think this is probably my closest escape, we had to run a telephone line across to the line of trenches, the reserve trench here where the attack started from. They ran up and they advanced about 3/4 of a mile. And then they dug in along through this shale, running down from the road to the Ebro. And they had a trench about a yard deep. It was easy to dig. It was like crumbling shale. And they wanted a telephone exchange line into right back to headquarters. Well, we got the line, but we had to cross this road. And we lost 4 people. Because once we crossed this road, then there's keyed up and they got wounded. And one was a German Trenkler, I remember him. He got it in the stomach and I dragged him out. He died later on. And all we wanted was to get this square on the road. There's a gully on the other side and you're pretty safe that you could creep your way along. But just crossing this road was murder. And we lost 4. Then there's only me left, so I had to have a bloody go. And I know my loaf must have worked overtime, because I thought, if I cross there, they can see that. They can work out where I am. So I'm not going across there. So I started running up as far as I could on one side of the road. And as they see me, they couldn't sight me. And then I darted back diagonally, trailing a pretty big reel of telephone wire, which weighed about 30, 40 pounds. I had to get this across, and I humbled it, and I got it across. And the wire was running out behind me. Anyway, once I got it across, I got up to the trenches, all that, and stayed there. And that was it. We got an exchange in, we got things going. And then we had another attack in the afternoon. And there was a fellow, I think his name was Watkin, all fresh out. You know, this sort of 5 minutes of glory. A lovely lad. Only about 21, 22, about the same age as myself. And had to attack right against the tanks. Just this, again, Russian tanks. Three or four Russian tanks came through. And they went over our trench and we followed them. Well, they followed, I didn't. I was looking up over the top. This ran about a dozen yards, he was riddled. He'd nothing, you know, no gun. He had a little one of these pocket pistols, brandishing him, just like a soldier you see in the pictures. And well, he was riddled. And we didn't get far at all. Now the tanks went right into the village, there's no support. They waited about half an hour and they came back, and on the way back one of them got hit. And a couple of Russians, one was wounded, shouting there. We had to wait tonight till we got them out. And got them back into the trench. And the following morning, Fletcher, who was in command, was told to attack, and he refused. Because it was bloody suicide. And Kopich was at the other end, Chopich, saying, get on, attack. What with? We'd lost about 40 or 50 killed, and quite a number wounded. And we were lying in an unsheltered trench, absolutely spotted. And the moment that attack started, that's when the artillery opened up a really blasting barrage. But fortunately for us, it went right over us on the main reserve trench. And that's where Chopich was, down in there. They really got it plastered. It went on for over half an hour, you know, real First World War stuff. Bung, 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 bung. And you could see the alternation between the white and the... I think the German artillery always had the black smoke, you know, and and then the white smoke, with the erratic shells, are there. And But I don't think it was a real undo. Anyway, following day, that was when Tommy Moore was killed. They plastered our front line trench, and they made the trench a bit deeper and got in dugouts with no real support. And the, you know, the shells that landed just a bit in front caused this to. And I got down the trench not to dig them out. Only about 20 minutes before we got them out, they're dead. All of them. Tommy Moore, especially. I had to take his wristwatch off, and his papers, and hand them back. We buried them. It was a real do. Anyway, they didn't attack us. There was a sort of static line then. Eventually, we withdrew. Now, that was the time, I've made a note of it down here, we were absolutely short of equipment. And the chap in charge of the signals, an American Wobbly, Pat Reed, who was quite a character. I don't know whether you came across him at all, but he was Pat Reed, a toothless, gimpy-looking American, sharp feature.
You see, he was a Wobbly.
Yes, he was one of the remaining Wobblies. He used to tell me stories of the life in America. It was how they used to work, go the rounds, work through. They used to have a number of jails. They had a circuit, you know. Yeah. And they'd set off working the jails. I told you about it, haven't I, Judy? And in those days in the South, the governors of the prisons got so much for every prisoner, they put up, you see, from the state. They made a living out of it, so. Pat and his father, who worked, they'd go on the rails, they'd go on the bomb, they'd do a bit of fruit working, anything that was, and when they were stuck, they'd get down in these jails and stay there for a week or two, then they'd move on. And the governor was always glad to see them, and they'd have drinking and have a good meal and a rest and move on. So there's quite a lot of it. They had a recognised route in which he could go right up to Canada. And come down on the other side, work, follow the seasons round. He was a real roustabout. He told me lots of tales. And funnily enough, because he was anarchistic I think he was one of the few remaining Wobblies, because he'd be about 40, 50 then. And the Spaniards, a lot of the Spaniards, they absolutely were devoted to him. This is Spanish, is more broken than anything, you know, my Chinese, and I don't speak any Chinese, but he got through to them. Barcino was there, he translated to them, and I would translate, and they were absolutely devoted to them. And when we were up on this front, they said, look, we got news that way back in Lérida, which is about 20-odd miles back, it was the sort of second city of Catalonia, more or less, they've got oodles of stuff. So Pat says, we'll do something about this. So Barcina and myself, because we spoke Spanish and I was a sergeant then, we got submachine guns, rifles, a couple of trucks, all the money we could lay hands on, and we nipped off from there down to Lérida. These Spaniards took us round to their pals and they opened the sort of big town hall. I don't know if it was the church or the town hall, but inside there, it was like a genie's cave. There was brand new, standard Ericsson stuff, which is all the Spanish stuff was run by Ericsson's, the standard. And in fact, the standard telephone building on there. Brand new, boxed, centrals, telephones, wire. There. All stacked up. All syndicalist, the stuff. You know, when the break came, they wouldn't cooperate and they hung on to the stuff. There's enough stuff in there. I think there's more stuff in that town than there was in Madrid. Really. And we looked at it. And this fellow says, you know, help yourself. Because the Spanish told him about Pot. He says, the greatest, you know. And, he said, take what you want. And we took it. We loaded that truck up with everything to do, wire, phones, exchanges. Anything we thought we could use, even carriers, we loaded it up. Then we got the second truck. We gave them all the money he had, and we loaded up with food, chocolate, butter, cheese, wine, the lot. And we went back. And from going, you know, we've got the morning, we're back by just after lunch.
Yeah.
And I thought of all that stuff down there. And later on, when the breakthrough came, you know, they took all that, just fell into Fasci's hands. Now, that was only electrical equipment and food stores. God knows what there was in the way of arms and stored somewhere else around there. That was the one thing we were perpetually short of, stuff, supplies. Because we always seemed to get enough, and I think we were the most favourably treated. We all seemed to have sufficient, but not too much.
Mm.
And enough to start with, never enough to finish with. That seemed to be our continual trouble.
Mm.
But anyway, we went back on there, and then eventually we were withdrawn again. And went all the way back down to Valencia. Back up to our rest place. We'd only been there a fortnight. We went all the way back to retake the position of the same. But apparently some marineros or whatever, Spanish battalion, or what it, I think they were marineros, had taken over the line, and the first attack they'd crumbled and given it all up. So everything we fought for was all more or less lost. Then we rested up from there, and it was getting late, and then we set off on a long march to Teruel. And that was the place where we marched about 40-50 miles, and we had to march all night and rest up by day, keep out of sight. And again, I think, at the attack. It took place at Christmas, wasn't it cold. And
it was snow,
cold, bitter, up in the mountains. And Teruel was in a sort of little valley like that, and the mountains were all around, and we attacked them. It took purely by infantry work, I think. No, pure infantry enveloping movement. On the colonel, put a mirror to my mouth.
Mm.
I thought there was something funny going on. And I saw all this. And anyway, I got back in. This is how it seemed to be at the time. I just sort of got back in. I was just purely objective, and I woke up. Now, still pretty rough, but I seemed to recover then. And I gradually got better. Now, it struck me as a sort of hallucination. I don't know if I really discussed it. But since then, it's only in the last few years, I found out that this has happened to lots of other people too, you know. They've sort of witnessed their own disembodied thing. And while it doesn't make me believe in a spirit or soul or afterlife or anything like that, I feel there's something there we've been missing out on that is certainly of interest. I told you about it, didn't I, Judy? And anyway, this is just a little incident. Anyway, I went down to Valls, and from Valls, which is a very pleasant little place, about only about 20 patients there, and I got this treatment, which certainly fixed me up. And then they sent me down to Benicassim to get up, and I met Bill Alexander there and various others.
Is this after he had been wounded?
Yes, he was, had his knee trouble. And this was when the breakthrough came, was developing anyway.
Yes.
And I met various people down there. Anyway, the breakthrough came, and we're all rounded up, more or less, and including Bill with his knee, which suddenly got better. And we all went up. Straight up, and what's the sequence of events after that? I know, again, I saw the British battalion briefly, then I ended up with Merriman and the American unit on the signals bureau. I had to keep the signals contact with them.
That was in Belchite, was it?
Hmm?
Was
no, this is at Gandesa.
Gandesa,
yeah.
Oh, well,
this was in the April, just on the breakthrough.
Oh, this is when it had been pushed back. Of that particular period. Mm. I remember that.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes, Merriman was in charge, and I was one or two, and I don't know whether it was good luck or bad luck, because while I was being split up with America, and that's when the British battalion was caught when Fletcher was wounded. And the rest were caught. So you can think about lines of fate. I was if it had been with the British battalion, I'd have been caught or shot. The American battalion, I was either caught or shot. I was caught.
Yeah.
The rest were killed.
We had to go through Gandesa and it was already occupied by the fascists.
Yes. Mm. Well, I was before that, ahead of that. And you know, as you leave Gandesa, you come back to a sharp rise on the hills. There's a long gulch going through, where just the road. Mm. And that's where I was caught at, an artillery barrage. And but anyway, before that, I was with the American unit, and we started really getting laced into.
Mm.
And I had no part in the decisions, of course. It struck me down. We didn't do any fighting. We just got the order to retreat and retreat. And when we finally stuck down, we were stuck right on an exposed part overlooking a road. And down this road was about 30,000 bloody Itais, fascists of all description, lined up. They were so sure of themselves. They were shelling away at front. We were on the side. And on the other side, if you try to get down, you're under machine gun fire from our own troops.
Mm.
So we're really exposed. And at night time, a lad said, "Get out." Merriman ordered the pull back. Now, we got a lot of wounded, no facilities. Some were being carried on stretchers, some were being helped, you know, like a retreat from Mons, pretty well. And we abandoned all the heavy weapons, machine, and just rifles and a few grenades. And then they came to this road, and he said, "Split into two." One half went, and I got across with them, and the other half didn't. I think some patrol or something got wise to them anyway. Merriman's half of the entire was just caught and wiped out, as I gathered afterwards.
Mm-hmm.
Of the others, we ran into a fair amount of fire. Some were wounded.
Mm-hmm.
A group of us retreated into the hills and worked back over there. And there was a long tunnel. Now, I think as I got on this long road through the gulch and came to this tunnel, I saw an ambulance departing. I think that was the last I saw. There'd been a sort of little hospital. And I, you know that nurse who was in the area, somebody, I think she was on that. I'm going to ask her about it when I see her. I think that was the last I saw of my side.
Mm.
So, because just as we were going on, I was overtaken by, the three of us actually, were overtaken by a motorcyclist patrol. Mm. There's no way out, just the rock. No, and they came right on us and, you know, I think we'd been moving for days, no food, like you know the feeling, no food, dead tired day and night, and you're sort of, you're not with yourself.
Mm.
And so I ended up captured. Now, I was then taken to Gandesa and put in the town jail. Now, this town jail had a peculiar setup. In the middle of it, underneath the floor, was an oubliette type of dungeon. You went in through the top, like a big bottle. You got down the ladder, and they pulled the ladder up, and there you were, you couldn't get out. I stayed there all night, there was a group of us.
Mm.
And 6 o'clock next morning, I know this, because I got the time. 6 o'clock, they pulled us out, and these are fascists, and guns, little group, line up, and marched us out around the edge of the town. I thought, you know, it's the usual thing. Because up to then, they'd killed pretty well every brigade that they caught. And I thought, well, I only hope I can get my hand up in time. You know, I thought, I'm just going to near this wall and shoot us, and that was it. Anyway, just as we got down there, an Italian officer took over. He said, we're going onto this truck. I don't know whether they did this deliberately to fool us, or it was part of the arrangement. He said, that's where the truck was. He led us all the way from, said, yeah, you know what, about a quarter of a mile.
Yeah.
Sure, they could have brought, if they wanted, they could have brought the truck up. It's just a thing that I often wonder about. Well, it's just a little exercise, you know. And, anyway, they handed us over. They put a little Itai truck, stuck us on, and then there we were, all the way to Burgas.
Mm.
I got the shock of my life when they got into Burgas, because there's the British battalion. Well, one company of it, anyway, Fletcher's company. Waited, they'd been caught on block. As I say, a few got away, Fletcher was wounded, and so there we were. Plus, During the next few days, he started accumulating others. Some Americans trickled in. Some Cubanos.
There was an awful lot.
A real, an Indian.
Yeah.
Frank Ryan.
Yeah. I was with Frank that morning.
Were you? Yes. And
do you know what they did to him?
Well, so, what? Who? When?
They tried to repeat the story of Roger Casement with him. They murdered him.
Mm.
I found his grave in Dresden in the German convents.
All this is, you mean, later on, in, after the war, yeah?
Yes.
But he was in jail with us, you know,
yes,
and he was
right.
Deaf and...
But he was eventually handed over to the Germans.
Yes, now, when we went, we were eventually released. He stayed behind, you know. So, the Americans stayed behind.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just the British, just British prisoners were taken
away. Well, why was that?
Oh, don't ask me. I wasn't in on the arrangement.
But for a particular reason.
We were visited by a Colonel Martin, who was the sort of British charge, unofficial consul in Burgas. Now, as far as he's concerned, I owe him a debt of gratitude. We could have been ruffians, we could have been louts, we looked it. You know, could have been the scum of the earth.
Mm.
But he treated us as gentlemen.
Mm.
He helped us. He got us something... papers to read, books to read, and a few things necessary, and even got his daughters to write to us, dear prisoners, you know, and see how we're going on, to cheer us up and say things are, we're trying to effect an exchange. And conditions in Burgas, you don't need me to tell you, there's enough documentation on it, they were pretty grim.
Yes.
And I look back, I still... look back on it, you know, after all these years, it's still there. Various ups and downs. We were fed very, very badly. Conditions were primitive. We were running with lice. Had our heads shaved. We're taken out about once every 2-3 days for about half an hour, with more guards in small groups, more guards than prisoners, although this is on a wild part of the... ground, a bit an old abandoned monastery, and there are about 2,000 inmates in it, nearly all Spaniards. We had just had one wing, one wing and everything, you know, no toilet facilities, just a trap and a touch of running water. We had given one of these oversized sardine tins to eat, we eat out of. We got a skilly soup in the morning, a sort of olive oil and bread in it. And a rough meal at night, two meals a day, and a one piece of bread, which is a sort of ricey bread, and that was our ration. Now, this ginger organised a few cronies, including one Australian. I hope to meet up with him. I think I know him, call him Digger or what. I forget his name now. He's a tough lad, but he was one of the non-politicals. I was going to say, this chap was sort of mercenary, sort of fortune. Ginger was an ex... British Army private, you know, and I think, I don't know, he drifted in this from adventure or what. They're real tough. But no political persuasions. He got one or two more, and they tried to corner and steal their share of soup. It's a great big bin, a dustbin full of this soup was brought in. And, you know, it left us to share out, and another was given to the Yanks, and another to the... And he thought he'd do a bit of bullying tactics. But, you know, that's yours, and we'll have this, and hang on to the rest. And... there's nothing concentrates a man's capacities like hunger, because we used to dream of food, talk of food, and sleep food, you know. And it was fantastic. We were so bloody hungry, that's all we ever dreamed of. And I can still remember the Americans describing some of the meals, their ideal meal about a plank steak, in which you slice two pieces of steak and put another piece in between and grill it until the juice of the tops and the bottom one run through and cook the middle, and you eat that and throw the other two bits away. And all the, you know, the long dishes they had. And you'd slaver and starve. And the only thing that kept our minds, or took our minds off food occasionally, was the bloody lice running up and down. There really were bitten. Red, one chap next to me was absolutely massive, red mottled. We used to call him Wrigley Ride. I saw him later on in Bristol during the war. And he was a bit of a demoralised lad, you know, sort of drifted into it, not very strong. But We just organised a quick beating up campaign of our own, and well, I told Ginger that was it. Share and share alike, or that way there wouldn't be any ginger. And that used some of down then.
Told him.
And but one of the things there I think is worth noting, among the prisoners was a Turkish language professor, teacher of language, and his job in life, you know, to pass the time, he took a group of us and taught us German. Now, with no pencils or writing paper, and we used to walk about in groups. First of all, it kept you going and stopped you scratching, and it helped. So he was teaching us German. So I picked up quite a bit of German that way on the hoof, you know, and it all done mentally. And one day I got a bit of an old cement bag, you know, the different layers, and got a little bit of paper, and I scrambled a bit of pencil from somewhere, and I made notes on these, you know, with bits of brown paper. And I brought these home with me. Now, I don't know what's happened to them. It's years since I came home, of course, and I treasured those. Anyway, this fella was also teaching the commandant of the prison to speak German. And he took him out once a day, had a lesson, he gave him a glass of wine and some cigarettes. So he, that's coming down to us on the make-up. Now, again, another thing, on we were lined up outside the, in the courtyard, outside this thing, under guard, and the Gestapo came along to check up on us. We're all photographed and checked up on.
Fingerprinted?
Yeah. And the Germans... There were some Germans in the prison. They were taken away, and that was it. The next time we lined up, some British pressmen, a group of pressmen, including a British, came along, another look at us. Trying to, you know, see the first captured internationales, you know. And now, among those was one called Jimmy Rutherford. You know Jimmy.
Oh, yeah.
Now, he'd been captured before. He's only a youngster, 19, and he'd come back again under another name. And... well, we were real bloody scarecrows. We were in rags, our heads were shaved. You know, your own mother would not have recognised you. That this Times correspondent came along and he recognised Jimmy Rutherford.
They had his fingerprints, anyway.
And, yes, but he recognised him and he spoke to him. And I've seen you before, don't I know you? No, no. And he went away and Jimmy says, I know that bugger. I've seen him before and he knows me. The day after, he was taken away.
He's a member of the Edinburgh, we will give
you. So that was one of the...
Fingerprinted him when he was first captured, he came home. You should never have let him go out again.
No.
Shouldn't have left it to her. He's only 19. And I was lying with him outside Bill Sheedy. Yes, Bill Sheedy, you know, when the awful... And he knew what would happen to him.
Oh, well, we were the last to see him alive.
He,
and he knew it, you know, and he went very quiet, withdrawn, and I think he realised his number was up. And we couldn't do a bloody thing about it, so we felt as bad as he did. And he was very, very friendly with Joe Norman, who was a friend of mine, you see. Sort of the three or four of us together. There was his pal, Joe Norman and Jimmy. Joe was a sort of father to him, you know, and... I was a pal of Joe's because I knew him, I had known him from Salford, knew him in the past, and...
he's in Corby now, you know that?
Yes, oh yes. As with his brother George when he died recently, you know, to cancer. Anyway, as I say, there we were in prison. I think the idea of an Englishman learning German of a Turk in a Spanish prison... is international. I don't think you can get any more international than that. So it's one of my pleasanter memories. The other pleasant memory there, I was taught to play chess. Now, when I was a kid at school, you know, I was fairly bright. I thought I was the bee's knees at chess. You know, I'd play a good game. And well, this chap, a little diminutive American Wallach, he's called. Now, as far as I understand, he was one of the 12 ranking players in America. Why he went out, God only knows, he wanted another move, I suppose. And anyway, he taught us all chess again to the town. It's largely mental. Until one day somebody got a bit of dirty grey blanket and a bit of indelible pencil and made a chessboard on this blanket, and we got bits of our bread, saved it, and we had the white pieces squeezed with spittle, made a set out of that, rubbed a bit of dirt in the others, and we had some black pieces, or greased black pieces. Yeah. And they used to demonstrate, you know, their manner. And that chess he taught me, you know, absolutely took me to pieces. You realise he didn't know a thing. It was lasting